To listen to Business Movers 1 week early and ad-free, join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Download the Wondery app in your Apple or Google Play mobile app store today. It's the morning of November 12, 1984, in an elevator at Hewlett-Packard's headquarters in Palo Alto, California. Chuck House, an engineering director at HP, steps out of the building's elevator and walks toward his office. But just as Chuck is about to step inside, he notices the open door of the office next to his, which belongs to the now partially retired Dave Packard. Chuck sees Dave inside, but he doesn't say hello. Instead, Chuck steps into his own office, takes a seat behind his desk, and prepares his to-do list for the day. Chuck looks up from his desk. In his doorway, he sees the scowling face of a man he recognizes as someone from HP's PR department.
Chuck, what did I do this time?
The PR man walks over to Chuck's desk and produces a sheaf of papers.
Look, this isn't funny, Chuck. You can't be saying these sort of things. What are you talking about? This...
Chuck watches as the PR rep throws the papers on his desk. They're pages from a book manuscript titled Entrepreneuring, Why You Don't Have to Leave the Corporation to Become an Entrepreneur. Chuck scans the documents and realizes they include an interview he did 2 years ago. In that conversation, Chuck recounted a story from nearly 20 years before that. Dave Packard had wanted to scrap a project Chuck was working on, but Chuck defied him, earning him a fake award from his coworkers called the Medal of Defiance.
I don't see what this is about. You don't see what this is about. You're basically saying that defying the CEO is good business. No, it doesn't look great, but that's an old interview. No, it doesn't matter. You made Dave sound belligerent, and this is a bad look for him and the company. One of us needs to call up this writer and tell him to admit the story. Oh, gosh, is this really necessary? Yes, Chuck, it is. Well, look, the way I see it, Dave is the only person being cast in a bad light here. So why don't we let him decide whether this gets published? He's in the office today. Well, for your benefit, I wanted to keep this between us. But if you insist, let's go see Dave.
The two men walk to Dave Packard's office. As usual, the door is open. The PR rep watches nervously as Chuck takes the lead.
Hey, Dave, you have a moment?
Sure, Chuck, come in.
What's up?
Well, Dave, there's this book I got interviewed for almost 2 years ago. You're probably not going to remember this, but it was, 17, 18 years ago. But I talked about that display I worked on that you wanted to scrap, but I put into production anyways. Well, we got the manuscript, and we wanted to make sure my words don't ruffle any feathers.
Chuck watches as Dave flips through the manuscript, pausing at a photo of Chuck holding the Medal of Defiance. Seeing it, Dave smiles.
Oh, young man, I certainly remember this.
Chuck watches as Dave begins to wag his index finger at him.
Chuck, learn from me. You're in a position now where you too can stop lots of good things from happening. I want you to remember that.
Chuck smiles. He cuts his eyes at the PR rep. Then he asks one more time for the avoidance of doubt.
Well, Dave, are you sure you're okay with this being published?
Oh, yeah, print it.
In 1939, in a one-car garage in Palo Alto, Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard formalized their partnership and set out to create a successful electronics company, one that would change the world. While HP's products found success, it was the company's unique culture that became HP's hallmark. Guided by what they called the HP Way, Bill and Dave built an organization that encouraged independent action and even celebrated dissent from employees like Chuck House. But when Bill and Dave retired from HP, the company faced a new chapter that would give the HP Way its first real stress test, leaving many to wonder if the company's foundational principles would survive without the founders there to protect it.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. From the beginning, Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard built HP around principles of fairness and egalitarianism. In their garage in Palo Alto, the two tossed a coin to decide whether their company would be Hewlett-Packard or Packard-Hewlett. Even after they left the garage for their own office building, Bill and Dave carried their principles with them. And for decades, HP's founders centered their company around the HP way, striving to create an organization built on mutual trust and respect. By many accounts, Bill and Dave succeeded. But following the founders' retirement from HP in the late 80s and early 90s, there were those who suspected the HP way was also on its way out. Though the HP way remained the company's guiding philosophy, as time went on, many began to question whether the ethos was simply a relic of the past. This idea was reinforced when tumult and scandal began to plague the company that was once seen as Silicon Valley's leading corporate citizen. In the first decade of the 2000s, HP went through five different CEOs. In both 2005 and 2010, the company had three different CEOs in the span of a single year. That same decade saw HP in the headlines for a spying scandal, a sexual harassment inquiry, falsified expense reports, and the forfeiture of long-promised company benefits. In the wake of what seemed like a constant stream of negative press attention, many in the media made the same declaration. HP had lost its way. Here to talk about the evolution of Hewlett-Packard and the HP way is Chuck House, HP veteran and expert on corporate innovation. Here's our conversation. Chuck House, thank you so much for speaking to me today on Business Movers.
It's a pleasure.
Now, you started out as an engineer at Hewlett-Packard in 1962. Back then, what drew you to the company?
What drew me to the company were two things. One is the chance to get a master's degree with them paying for it at Stanford. I was married, had two kids, so the notion of a bachelor's degree was sort of, I'd already blown that. And so I had a chance to have someone else fund further education. And my major professor had said, you want to work at a company where they're doing interesting work. And he said, the interesting thing about an instrument company is they have to work on products to help other people who are working at the state of the art. And in order to do that, the instruments have to be better than the state of the art. So you're always working on the frontier. And that sounded very appealing.
So you stayed at Hewlett-Packard then for how long after 1962?
I was there 29 years.
29 years. All right. And you have written a book about the company, The HP Phenomenon. In it, you wrote that HP became better known for its cultural practices than its products. What was the HP way that you describe as its cultural practice, and how did this HP way make it different from its other neighbors in Silicon Valley?
Well, most companies are known by the key products that they develop and sell. And HP, being in the instrument business, built a wide variety of instruments for lots and lots of fields, physics, chemistry, astronomy. So no product sold in huge quantities, but the bulk of them together made quite a package. And the question of where these ideas all came from was really from the distributed engineering staff. And so early on, the founders adopted the promise for engineers like myself that you could bring ideas for new fields of endeavor and start those. And so what happened over time was we recreated sort of the base products of the company over six decades. Six different leadership categories of products became HP. So you could never say it was HP the voltmeter company or HP the peripherals company or HP the computer company, because it always had something else going on. And how we did that was this innovative instinct that was allowed engineers basically in a decentralized, innovative kind of way. And that became known as the HP way of doing things.
How was that HP way codified in the early company culture?
Well, it was never written down, I'm told, until like 1976. So the company started in 1939. So, you know, we went 37 years without writing down what is the HP way. But it was understood that what it was this pass responsibility to the lowest individual, let them decide what to do and how to do it. Managers were there to help you get tools to do your job as opposed to manage you. It was a very different kind of operation.
I'm glad you characterize it as a very different type of organization, because when the HP way was formally laid out, certainly as it was in 1992, I believe, there's an encouragement of flexibility and innovation. And it seems like evidence of that is that you became the recipient of HP's first and only Medal of Defiance, which is a curious distinction. Explain how that award came your way.
Well, sure. It was kind of, I thought when I got it, that it was a gag gift. The day I got it was, I was leaving the HP Colorado Springs division to head to Palo Alto to head up a brand new group called Corporate Engineering. So I was becoming HP's chief engineer for all of its product lines. We had 91 divisions in multiple arenas, medical, chemistry, astronomy, computing, etc. My desk was going to be next door to Dave Packard, who had retired, but who still came in to work about 3 days a week. But the point was, at this going away party, I was handed a certificate. It looked something like you would get at Kinko's. Just said Medal of Defiance, and it had a set of words about a product I had built some 15 or 17 years earlier, and basically said, you know, this is awarded on behalf of instincts that went against corporate culture and prevailed. And dated April 1, 1982. I thought it was a gag gift. The fact that it said Dave Packard on it, I thought, I treated it more or less on one of those gag gifts you get when you turn 50. And it turned out he had commissioned it expressly because we were creating this office of corporate engineering, and he didn't want it to be in any way thwarting innovation around the corporation. So his way of signaling that innovation was still desired around the company was to create this award.
Let's dig a little deeper into this, because I think the story behind the story of Medal is perhaps fascinating. Your 2013 memoir about your career at HP is titled Permission Denied. So am I correct in saying that that title comes from this moment of defiance when you built a product against the wishes of Dave Packard?
So we were in the oscilloscope division, and the scope division at the time was a distant second to Tektronix in the field. But anyway, we were always looking for end runs or different ways of creating things. And I had encountered an opportunity to build a large screen scope, if you will, so we could build a product for FAA control towers. And I thought that'd be a great idea. We built the prototype for this. And the first encounter with Dave and Bill was our division review. And I was showing this, and nobody was very impressed. In fact, Hewlett was quite unimpressed. These things took a long time in development. A year later, they're out, and we were showing this box again. And our marketing manager, I wasn't in the room for this event, said that he had found opportunity for 31 units, to which Packard said, well, then cancel it. There's no market here. The next morning, I said, well, he didn't call my dad. My dad wants two of them. You know, it's a much bigger market. So anyway, I was given permission to do some trial market research. We came back pretty positive. We built the product. The next annual review, this product was in production, and we'd sold, I don't know, 40 or 45 units by then in about 3 months' time. And Packard was, I thought I said to kill this thing. And he had some, adjectives along with that statement that were pretty compelling. Witlessly, I stood up and said, no, sir, what you said is I don't want to see it in the lab next year. It's not. It's in production. Well, that wasn't that wasn't the answer he had in mind. So it didn't start out that they were pretty enthusiastic.
And so after your success with this project, though, I believe you gave a bit of a speech to HP about entrepreneurship. That speech might have ruffled some feathers, though.
probably a little headstrong at the time. My wife might say I still am, but we had some visiting people from Bell Labs and several other companies, and I was invited to give sort of a success story description of how this project happened. And I chose it to outline a little scenario. I said, there's a four-step process. When you introduce a really new idea, at first everybody scoffs. And then they discover that you're getting a little traction, and now they start actively fighting it. The third step is not only do they fight it, they start trying to modify it. And then when it takes off and it's really successful, they claim they did it in the first place. It turned out that wasn't well received by my own management, and they offered me an opportunity to go back to designing instead of managing.
I'm getting the notion that your career at Hewlett-Packard was one of color and perhaps a bit of friction. At the same time, I'm wondering, would you characterize these acts of defiance and dissent as part of the HP way?
So when we first started the book, my view was that, you know, I have the only award titled that. But as we went around to division after division, said, how did this division start? What were the roots that that led to this product arena? And invariably, we would be introduced to some guy in the corner who was considered the resident genius. And his story would almost always be that he had to fight top management to have the right to build whatever his idea was. So almost every division had their version of some innovative group, almost always an individual or two or three individuals who had bucked the system and been allowed to pursue their dream and pull it off. So in that respect, it was a pretty common thing in HP to have this local dissent supported adequately that some good things could happen.
You've mentioned the importance and centrality of Dave Packard and Bill Hewlett in the early years. And in your book, you wrote that many of those who joined HP from the 70s onward had, and I'll quote here, a view that Packard was a demigod with wisdom and perspective to whom we could all turn to for advice and assistance. But you said that the old timers knew better. In what ways did working with the men, Hewlett and Packard, complicate your perception with them? What did these old timers know that the newcomers didn't get insight into?
So Packard actually retired from HP formally in 1969 to take a job in Washington, D.C. as Undersecretary of Defense. And while he returned to the company in a board advisory position, he never returned to the company to run anything. And when he came in, it was largely, I don't want to say ceremonial, but it was, you know, it wasn't meetings that were active management. So we would see him as this philosopher almost, but not as a daily interactor. And so kind of it became a, you know, an elder statesman kind of view. Those that knew him more closely, though, knew that he had a pretty strong temper. He had no patience whatsoever for anything unethical or, for that matter, anything not well thought out. And, you know, he would write memos. This is patently absurd. You know, see me. You knew when you got a note like that. Uh-oh. We used to say the HP way stopped at rate range 7. And what that meant was any division manager, any manager of, say, a big engineering lab would be subject to his full and undivided attention, and it may not be pleasant whatsoever.
In your 29-year tenure at Hewlett-Packard, you've witnessed the company grow and change and evolve many times over. One of the biggest changes, certainly at the top, was probably the short reign of Carly Fiorina. In our series on Hewlett-Packard in this time period, Carly makes an appearance, and she certainly shakes things up. But I'm wondering, from an insider's point of view, how did her tenure change the culture of the company and maybe even the direction of it?
So truth in advertising, I had left HP 8 years before she came. So I'm not privy to how it actually felt being there at the time. I mean, I was in touch with an awful lot of people, and I actually, for the book, interviewed Carly at some length. And, you know, I've got some perspective. So we've collected a lot of information, but it's secondhand. I have to caution on that. She changed the egalitarian nature of the pay structures. in a way that said we're going to reward the top management and we're going to reward them based on performance metrics that are primarily business metrics and not innovation metrics. That just sent shockwaves through a company that had always prided itself on a relatively low spread between, you know, janitorial pay and the CEO's pay. Dave and Bill were, you know, had their stock collections to be sure, but none of us got rich out of the HP that they ran. A lot of us had good livings. She skewed that structure significantly, and I think that had widespread repercussions.
Let's dig a little further. What were these particular repercussions? Certainly, this is a condition of modern corporate America we understand today. Was HP needing to go in this direction? Or what were the failings that you saw as a longtime employee of the previous version of HP?
That's a great question. So let me offer a couple of perspectives here. The company had been led by Dave for a long time, obviously 1939 to 1969. By Bill Hewlett for the next 8 years, and then by John Young for the next, I think, 13 or 14 years, something like that. And John had been there 35 years, something. So there was a long history of people that understood the culture running it. Lou Platt, who also had a lot of time and grade, became CEO in 91 and served until Carly came along. Lou had a characteristic that the others lacked, or maybe I should say they had a characteristic that he lacked, and that was decisive decision-making. And under Lou's tenure, the company got really caught on the issue of, do we go down the path of personal computer path, or do we go down the high-performance computing path? And that schism that developed, as well as the one between computing and peripherals, wound up being basically a vulnerability where the company wound up looking mostly paralyzed, and also it was getting in the way of innovation of the historic sort. So when Carly came in, the view, I think, was that she, and I think she would correctly assess that it needed to be stimulated back into the innovative mode. You know, she had come out of Bell Labs, not a bad place to come from as a reference point. And so her instinct was to really try and re-galvanize innovation. The question, though, of how she went about it is where the rubber met the road. And she wound up empowering people who led from the top as opposed to re-stimulating leading from the bottom. Sometimes that's faster. No question about that. But it wound up building in this we-they between management and the innovation staffs. And I think that's where she got caught primarily.
This is a moment, 1999, of great change in the tech industry writ large, great change in global and American culture in how consumers relate to technology. Certainly things are moving and probably moving very fast, and HP has to keep up somehow.
2000-2001 was the dot-com bust. And a bust doesn't happen unless there was a boom, and the boom was like from 96 to 2000. And HP largely missed that. It missed the importance of the internet. It missed the importance of what became cell phones. It missed the widespread, what we called the Wintel package, for personal computing.
That brings up the question. We're characterizing HP in this moment as a company who is facing great change in the marketplace, great change in the technology that it attempts to be the leading innovator of. And we've discussed that it missed many of the trends that make modern society right now tick. So there's a game of catch up here and a great feeling of maybe missed opportunity, but certainly change. That describes the company, but let's talk about the board in particular. In this moment of change, what is the board's makeup, and how would you characterize it as, let's be generous and say that there's an old guard and a new guard, and what were the tensions that were brewing?
That's a great set of questions. So the Packard board forever was, I would describe it as a friends and cronies board. That might be an unkind way of saying it, but we had a number of really well-respected scientific minds were on that board. When we were a scientific instrument company, that was entirely appropriate. But that board, in many ways, persisted until Young stepped down. Packard actually engineered Young's decision to retire. And in the process, he Packard, was upset enough that he actually got rid of most of the board who had come up through the old HP. So there were Bill Terry, and I won't take you through the whole list, but there, you know, it was people who had grown up in HP and then sort of graduated to the HP board. He basically dismissed them and handed Lou Platt a board that included Dick Hackborn, who had been an antagonist and a contender for CEO, as well as they picked some newcomers. One of the holdovers was Jay Keyworth. He stayed with the board through that period. And as they got to Carly, Hackborn was instrumental in selecting her. Platt didn't last into that one. So there's kind of a new board that she constructed. You know, one view is kind of a modern era that is characterized by a much more dynamic, much more public-centric, and I will say public product-centric. You know, we're talking about products for every person, not products for the scientific community. The old guard found this troubling. You know, it was unsettling for those philosophical reasons. And then in addition, sort of the pay practices and all that, and then the Carly also had a streak of enjoying the limelight, which was quite antithetical to anything in HP's previous history. And so she really was earning non-credits, if you will, with the old guard, to be sure. And then when they bought Compaq, one other player joined the ranks, and that was Tom Perkins. And Tom had been at HP early. In fact, started the computer business for HP and then funded Tandem when they got started. And when Tandem got bought by Compaq, he stayed on the Compaq board. And he and Michael Capellas from Compaq now were on the new board. So they had really built factions, if you will, some of whom felt they knew technology quite well. And that was an interesting situation for Carly.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So we have this this new board that accompanies a new CEO and a merger, you know, bringing in new life and absolutely new approaches. Tom is, you know, a prototypical finance and venture capital person. It's interesting to know that Jay Keyworth was probably more of the older guard, but these two in particular kind of formed maybe one of the cliques moving forward that became very problematic for Patricia Dunn. She is the focus of our series, our four episode series here. Before we get into any particulars about her tenure in the spying scandal, I'd like to discuss what boards are really used for. We hear a lot about the decisions they make at the top, and it seems very political, but maybe it would be good to remind ourselves about what a good corporate board does.
Well, that's, you know, I've probably been on 18 boards along the way myself, and my wife's been on another half dozen, and, you know, as well as studying some of these Fortune 50 situations. Boards are in the main behind the scenes, and they are not expected to be technology conversant. They may become strategically involved to a modest degree. They are not there to ride shotgun on the management of the company in an operational way. Their role is primarily, in my view, to protect the heritage of the place in terms of its reputation, in terms of its stature in the community, in terms of its financial ethics. It's by and large seen as a passive role. And to expect otherwise, to expect them to get in a hands-on role is usually antithetical to most management teams and to most, outside students, I think, of boards in general. That's not necessarily what John Q. Public expects. They think, well, why can't they take action? Why don't they take action? And that's not really, in general, understood to be their role. At least that's my perspective.
Was a passive caretaker board what HP experienced in this time?
Yeah. Well, for the most part. So there's one thing, of course, that every board has ultimate responsibility for, and that's the succession plan. And so, the question HP faced when Lou has struggled with the dynamics of this radically changing world, the board's responsibility, obligation, was to figure out, is he the guy to still carry it forward, or would a change in leadership be appropriate? And their conclusion, I think correctly, was that a change would be appropriate. And then the question you can get into is, okay, so did they do a good job? And what were the criteria they used in order to go at that? Up front, I think a lot of people were, this predates Perkins joining the board. This is Hackborn primarily and some others, felt that Carly had the credentials. Not everybody was a fan of hers at the time, but she had, answered a bunch of the check marks on the box. The issues Carly developed with HP was she didn't perform fast enough, if you will, in terms of financial. She would put forecasts out that wouldn't be met. She had the idea with Pricewaterhouse that didn't work. She had the idea with Compaq, and while it worked to get it done, it was a fractious situation, and the result merger didn't produce the financial results as quickly, not nearly as quickly, as she had represented they might. So the board essentially lost faith with her on her operational performance, is my take of what happened. And that's an appropriate thing for a board to step into.
I'm interested that you characterize a board's role as protecting a company's heritage and its stature in the community, because certainly that's what it thought it was doing when it began investigating the leaks in 2005, 2006. It had some unintended consequences, though, that investigation. As an HP veteran, what was your reaction when the news of this spying scandal first broke?
Well, it was horrifying. Well, first of all, I never met Patty, but that didn't even happen under Carly. That happened well into Herd's administration, if you remember. The key thing I think about where the board found itself, and Patty and Herd were among them, is what's going on here? If you think about the books that had come out about Carly, and they came out 2003 or so, is my recollection. This is the book, one by Peter Burroughs called Backfire, and one by Perfect Enough, George Anders. Both had been long-term journalists for major magazines, Newsweek and Wall Street Journal and places like that. And the information they shared about the backstories inside it, the HP boardroom, around the Carly era, were stunning. Where did those come from? And how did those, who was the stoolie putting that kind of information out there? Was one of the questions on the street from about that era on. So Patty inherits that. And now there's all sorts of new stuff coming out about, what's going on with Carly, what's going on with the board. And I think it had to be a very difficult time for the board in terms of, who's ratting us out? What's going on here? We've clearly got a mole in the room or several. It's hard to do confidential work if it's not confidential.
Clearly, the methods and maybe even intent of the investigation went too far. But It is a serious problem to have confidential information, as you note, suddenly become public. So I'm wondering if we think about Hewlett-Packard in specific and maybe your tenure there with some of the older guards of the company, how could this have been handled differently?
Well, let me parry that question for a moment. In the book, we talk about Rick Belluzzo saying, you know, HP had, and Rick had been one of the senior VPs under consideration when the board was looking to replace Platt. But he said, you know, HP got to a position where they were unethical, in his view, quite so, with vendors, and would lead them on and cause them to make investments in things that HP had no intention of honoring. And we put a page or two in the book about that. I mean, you talk about somebody indignant beyond belief about that aspect of HP ethics. We had one later about that came out. This is actually more recent, where the peripherals group offered a system free ink for life. And they signed up a bunch of people over a four-year period, and then they reneged. And the outcry was, how could they do that? And the answer is, they had no trouble business-wise doing it. But, you know, from an ethics standpoint, they broke a strong promise. HP had way too many ethical lapses by the old standards. It wasn't just, you know, all of a sudden we've got somebody in the boardroom who's a mole sharing information. It's that the entire company has taken a big step away from ethical behavior that was unquestioned. And I think that made it harder than to develop an appropriate strategy for what they were facing.
In your estimation, how does a company slide in the wrong direction like that, especially a company who has a proud culture of integrity that they call the HP way? What is the progression towards unethical behavior?
Well, I think money speaks. You know, the top four people one year took $113 million out of the company the same year that they put everybody on a 10% pay cut. You know, I mean, things like that are just unconscionable. The meta message is that they began chasing with business ethics that weren't uncommon to corporate America, but they were quite uncommon to Hewlett-Packard. I'll use an example at the moment. I suspect most of the Russian populace didn't want to go into this war with the Ukraine, but the leader did. And, you know, when leadership does set a tone and can change a tone. And I think we had several in a row that did.
Let me ask an opposite but similar question. How does a proud company like HP resist the drift towards unethical behavior?
Well, I like the question. I wish I had a good answer for you. I think the actions I took with that resulted in the Medal of Defiance, writ large, is the responsibility of employees throughout the company. When ethics seemed to be broached, like in a case with misleading a vendor, person closest to that deal has a choice to make. And the question is, how did it used to get made in an ethical way, and what causes people to no longer do that? Are they the same people? Are the metrics by which they're being graded changed? You know, where does that happen? And I think, you know, whether it's democracy or whether it's ethics in business, these are essentially, fundamentally, decisions that people make individually in their own role, and aggregate is what prevails. And I think the metrics of performance grading got changed along the way, enough that it eventually that slide accelerated.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Certainly, this was a period of strife and transformation for HP, but it's been almost 20 years since the events broke. And it's not the first time HP has transformed. In fact, in your book, you've written that each time HP has transformed, that the doubters would say that the company has lost its way and it would never regain it. You, though, refute this, saying that the style of a company like HP, and I'll quote again, gets baked in, perpetuated, inculcated so deeply that it becomes ingrained, patterned, and virtually innate. As we are here in 2022, and you've watched HP grow and evolve into what it is today, has your belief in the integrity of the HP way remained?
Great question. Great question. One thing that shook my faith in that set of prescripts that I wrote is, what is the company? And the key thing I want to make here is when the acquisitions of Compaq on the one hand, and then later the software consulting side happened, and the divestiture of the instrument group had happened, all of a sudden, 75% of the people working for a company with the initials HP had longstanding heritage in other companies, not in HP. And so you've got kind of a minority cultural belief, you know, where 25% of the employees grew up in this one system and 75% grew up in other systems. And that fundamentally is where an awful lot of that went astray. It's a oil and water kind of mixture that I think became pretty compromised for HP. Now, fast forward past Heard, past Apotheker, into the Meg Whitman era, all of whom were outsiders, I might point out, and all of whom came from environments that were substantially different culturally than the, quote, old HP. Agilent, on the other hand, Agilent and then its derivative Keysight, by and large, are still populated almost entirely with HP cultural employees, and both companies have, by and large, I think, retained that ethos to which that paragraph you cited refers. So I think they kind of proved the case in a way. But let me come now to the divestiture of split of HP into HPE and HP Inc. We hired Dion Wexler for HP Inc., and he did, I think, a very credible job in getting them squared away, leaving aside the Free Ink scandal. And they, by and large, have thrived. Their revenues are up. Their profits have retained. They are still the preeminent peripherals company on the globe over a 30-year period, which, by the way, is exceptional. HPE, on the other hand, they nominated in Neri a leader who shared some of the old culture. And he has brought back, I think, enormous enthusiasm for, certainly for the ethics side. He has not brought back revenue and profits at all. In fact, it's a stunning, you know, reduction of that corporation. But if you look at things like Ethosphere, which grades corporate ethics around the world, he has made the list the last 4 years. HPQ made it last year. So I think we're seeing in some respects that the really old guard, the desire to play by, quote, the old rules, is still a pretty strong instinct in the derivative elements of these spawns that have come out of this company.
This old culture, the original HP way, and perhaps the most important HP way, I'm glad to hear that you think there's a resurgence, because this is a business show, and we like to leave our listeners with lessons that they can take and put into action into their careers and lives. Having dealt with the legends of this company, Bill Hewitt and David Packard themselves, what lessons do you think they can give our listeners in leadership in terms of culture and innovation?
I think the question is, what did they support that made it what it was? Profit sharing hadn't been happening around in corporate America hardly at all before they came along. Flexible work hours hadn't happened. You know, extended medical coverage hadn't happened. Things, management by wandering around, the MBWA kinds of ideas, where the top management is known by and his partner, if you will. These were kind of new at the time. And certainly today, with the change in how we do, remote work because of the COVID experience and because of the tools, in fact, the tools we're using for this interview, you know, it's a different era to be sure. But I think a lot of the things that they espoused were based on the dignity of the individual, decisions at the lowest level by the people that know best what to do. You know, it augurs well for business today to use those same kinds of principles. So it isn't that there's any fringe package or any specific action. It's just the trust in people that they want to do the very best job they can. And your job as a leader is to encourage and support them to do that.
Well, Chuck House, thank you so much for talking about Hewlett-Packard with me today. It's been really insightful.
Well, I've enjoyed it, and I hope this is of some value for your listeners.
That was my conversation with Chuck House, founder and CEO of the Innovascapes Institute, a management consulting service focused on corporate innovation. To learn more about HP's history and the lessons we can learn from it, check out Chuck's book, The HP Phenomena. From Wondery, this is the final episode in our series on the HP spying scandal. On the next season of Business Movers, The King of Booze. When Prohibition takes hold in the 1920s, a German immigrant named George Remus sets out to create a bootlegging empire. Spurred on by his keen business mind, his obsession with success, and the woman he loves, George will become one of the wealthiest and most powerful men in America. But in the end, greed, lust, and betrayal will cost him nearly everything he's worked for. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. If you'd like to learn more about the Hewlett-Packard spying scandal, we recommend The Big Lie, Spying, Scandal, and Ethical Collapse at Hewlett-Packard by Anthony Bianco, Comebacks by Andrea Redman and Patricia Crisafulli, and The Kona Files by James Stewart, an article in the February 2007 issue of The New Yorker. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is produced by Alexandra Curry Buckner. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship and Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.